All right, so talking to Alex again, Alex Ojeda.
Hey, gang.
So, Alex, do you have, like, businessy things that you want to make the world aware of? You know, as long as you're doing this, go ahead and abuse this airtime to meet your own stuff.
Well, here, let me get this thing out of the way. I'm sure everybody just heard that. I've got a little website called homesteadgear.com where I am trying to sell these awesome permaculture t-shirts. Maybe somebody could go out there and tell me these are going to be all organic t-shirts. And they're going to have specifically Wheaton-approved sayings and things on them. And all permaculture-esque. These are things that I feel strongly about. So when you walk around town, you can have, you know, people ask you, what the heck does that mean on your shirt? And then you'll have time to, you'll have a reason to talk. You know, you can okay. Wax philosophical about permaculturally things.
All right. Okay, cool. And I know you and I have talked about all kinds of ideas of things to put on that site and stuff. So I'm looking forward to it. And by the time this podcast becomes available to people, there all the t-shirts will be in and ready. And I think but based on the time that we're recording it, they're ready today, right? Today's the day.
That's right. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of reviewing right now the invoice, and that means that they are being shipped out, and
awesome.
They're coming UPS.
Oh, good. Good. Well, the ones for me anyway. I know you're sending me a lovely care package.
True.
So, and I look forward to getting it. And I'll see both kinds. And it sounds like I know you and I have talked about other designs in the future and other objects in the future. I'm pretty excited about all the swag. We're going to be swag intense.
Right. Well, you know, all the other cool people have swag. Permies need swag too.
That's right.
That's right.
And we have the glass mugs and the t-shirts that I designed, but I'm not an artist. I mean, basically what we've got is, like, I think the t-shirts that I designed, it's like I got to clear those out quickly.
Right.
Get rid of those. And then before people find out about your t-shirts.
Oh, gotcha.
Otherwise, I'll be stuck with these things forever.
Right.
But I think the glass mugs we have are cool. And I know that there were, like, when I was looking for mugs, I was originally going to get ceramic mugs, but I've heard, I kept finding this stuff, like, you know, different levels of certification about there's stuff in some of the ceramics that's, like, toxic. And so then more and more I read about that, it's like this got to be this thing where it's kind of like, imagine food ceramics, that the ceramics themselves have toxins that we haven't really been able to figure out yet.
Right.
And they're currently working on what should be banned. And it's like, and part of me is kind of like, well, you know, somebody somewhere is making money, therefore they're not going to ban anything. On the other hand, the flip side of it is it's gotten so bad and so many people are getting sick from it that they've decided to overcome that. And that kind of got me, it engaged my heebie-jeebie factor.
Right.
And so then the mugs that I got were all glass. They're pure glass.
Oh, wow.
And so no ceramics. And all it is like I just put, you know, front and back, a whole bunch of obnoxious permaculture topics.
permies.com topics.
Yeah. And so it's just like background noise, but if you look closely at it, it's like it's saying 2005 called and they want their cob oven back.
Right.
Stuff, obnoxious stuff like that.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, and I've got some of those still, but I'm not gonna try and clear those out. I think those are really actually kind of cool. I like my glass mug a lot. So, all right, moving right along. I do have we're going to talk about this next chunk of Seth Pulitzer's book, and in a moment. But before that, I was visiting with somebody earlier today. And they made a really good point. They said that this person was talking about how there's like a dozen people in their community that are all listening to my podcasts, and they're all farmers. And then they get together and they talk about what they've listened to, and And their point is that even though they keep listening, and they're arguing about all the things that I say, the overwhelming consensus among them all is you can't believe a damn thing this guy says because he doesn't actually have a farm right now.
Right.
And my response to that is, good point. Your point is valid, absolutely. And stop. You know, you don't have to listen to anything I say for one. But it's kind of like I worry about that myself. How can anybody listen to anything I have to say? Because I don't currently have a farm, and I have to admit I have this ongoing dilemma about getting the farm, and I feel. The bizarre, weird thing is, and now, first of all, I had a farm, and I've had many gardens. I've had many, many gardens, and there's a lot that I did on the farm, and plus, right when I was really getting into the really, really good and intensive stuff, and I was building lots of ponds, and I terraced the land and all that stuff, and then I chose to leave that farm. And now I'm on this path. And I'm cranking out all the podcasts and the videos and the articles and blah, 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 blah. And it is a mystery. I just feel powerfully compelled to follow this path. And I have to admit that it does seem odd that anyone would listen to what I say, but I also feel like the moment I get land, I would think I'm going to drop all this stuff like a hot rock. Because I had all kinds of web junk going on before I got the 80 acres. And then once I was on the 80 acres, I hardly spent any time doing any online stuff. I like pretty much dropped everything. So it's, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a little distressing. Don't tell me all that stuff.
Yeah.
You do have the benefit of having had a farm and also having seen more farms than most farmers have and homesteads and permaculture settings and gardens and things like that. So it's not as if it's just your opinion. I mean, this is definitely well-educated. I mean, think about it.
I kind of feel like there is some of that, but at the same time, I've got a lot of things to try, and I got a lot of. I mean, I do feel powerfully compelled. Like the whole thing with the chickens. You know, I've got all these ideas about breeding my own breed of chickens, and which I've posted in my article about raising chickens. And then the Wafati. I mean, how can anybody believe that a Wafati is a worthwhile idea until one exists?
True.
And it's like been years now since I've written that article, and it's so there's all this stuff. And at the same time, it's like so the other thing that this person brought up, which you know is the next phase of it, and that is that it's like in a way I am farming 1,000 farms, and so because there are a lot of people that are listening to what I have to say, and. And then they are changing the way that they farm based upon the things that they've heard me say. Because they've come, they listen to it, and then they're trying it, and they are having success. And so now they're trying more of the things that I say, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. On top of that, I'm visiting a lot of these farms where they are doing the things that I suggest, and visiting with them about ways that they've optimized it further. As well as like, you know, the fact that they've had success or whether they've had any kind of problems with it. So there is this idea of like I can go and I can do it on my farm, and then there's this whole idea of like what if the podcasts get listened to by a million farmers and I like change the way agriculture is. So it's a little bit hard to walk away from that.
Right. Well,
you know, like, doesn't that kind of feel like that's what you ought to do?
You're just going to have to figure out how to have a like an iPad that's hooked to your whatever you're doing that day, you know?
Yeah.
I've got a scythe with an iPad on it, you know?
I'm not sure because, of course, once you get on the farm, and this is, you know, one of the reasons why it's hard to do a lot of the stuff that I do because it's like I get to I'll call up a farm, I want to come by, I want to make some video or whatever because what you're doing is cool, and they're like, I'll try to come up with some time today, but, you know,
right.
I might not be able to.
Right, right.
Because it's like, you know, 15 hours a day every day. And, you know, it's like, it's hard to come up with the extra time. And it's the same kind of thing. I know that when I had the farm, it's like I was just powerfully compelled to just put in huge tracts of time doing stuff on it.
I completely understand that.
So, I mean, it's awesome. Farming is the best.
Now, and on your farm, you would be farming to create produce to sell, like as in commercial level stuff, right?
When I was on the farm, so the last time I was on the farm was 2005. And when I was there, a lot of the work that I was doing when I was out there making the terraces, part of the mission was that on each terrace, I still wanted to grow crops that you could harvest with a tractor, because I kind of felt like the mission was to have a higher yield per acre with less expense for fertilizers and whatnot. And, like, at the same time, from the same land, pulling off crops of other things. So I kind of felt like a lot of the farmers out there, you know, they love their tractors and toys. And so what I wanted to do was to be able to demonstrate something where it's like, okay, you can have all your tractors and toys. You can keep all that, you know, and make more money. You know, so then what I wanted to do is, like, take the whole idea of the windbreak and like, have that every 100 feet or so. And so then that way they could still have the crops that they go and they take on with their tractor, only in theory it'll be, you know, more abundant. So that was my mission in 2005.
Which sounds kind of like a transition farm. You know, like it's sort of a transition from one kind of farming to permaculture.
True. So there would be examples of permaculture, and there would be examples of some somewhat more conventional agriculture going on in between the rows of permaculture-ish stuff. So, you know, a lot less insect damage, and therefore you don't have the fear of insects wiping everything out, stuff like that. So now as I was putting those in, I started getting ideas for things far beyond that. And now, ever since then, that's been more of my mission, where I keep thinking that the thing to do, because a lot of people, it's like, I'm going to make me a permaculture farm, and it's going to be a demonstration to other people on how to do it awesome. And then you never hear from them again.
Right.
Now, I mean, that seems to be like the siren call. It's like everybody gets that idea. Everybody wants to do that.
Well, I'm hoping that means that they went out, created the thing, are so in love with it, they never want to leave to even tell anybody.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. Maybe that's what happened.
Right.
So now my thinking is because it's like you start thinking about like a market garden. That was your question, market garden. Are you going to do a market garden? And I just kind of think I can imagine being in a liaison-ish relationship with somebody who would do the market garden at the market using the food that came from my farm, and I hope that they sell it for some freaky huge amount of money. But I don't foresee myself being at that market garden. So there's that. I really kind of believe that the money is going to be in bringing people to the land, and having them. I mean, I just kind of look at. I heard about, so like I it's so complex. I've heard about people going out and saying, so there, like when I took my PDC in 2005, there was a gal there that was working at, what is it, Martha's Vineyards or some kind of, it just sounded like something where it's like people who come and stay somewhere and they are paying like $5,000 a day to be there. And, you know, it just sounded insane, the amount of money that people spent each day to hobnob with each other. And then I take that idea, and then I combine it with the problem that we had with the electric car not long ago, where people, the general idea in most people's brains was that the electric car didn't go over 40 miles an hour, and it's for a bunch of hippie hobbyists and stuff like that. And then along comes the people doing the Tesla, where they, you know, they're saying, we're going to sell this car for $100,000, which is $400,000 cheaper than you're going to get a Lamborghini, and it'll kick ass on the Lamborghini.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so then that, and then it's like they had, demand was massive. And here's a car that can go 200 miles an hour, or I don't know how fast it goes, but it goes 0 to 60 faster than like anything else on the road. And it's kind of like, now everybody's like, the electric car, man! And so then it's kind of like, why can't we do that with permaculture? Why not stand up and say, here we have a permaculture farm, and this is the best food available in the United States, according to me. I really don't care what the rest of you think. And you want to come and stay on my permaculture farm for a week, that's fine. It's $10,000. And, you know, so it seems, it strikes me, and $10,000, that's cheaper, that's $50,000 cheaper than staying at that place over there in wherever that is that those people that are paying too much were staying.
Yeah, right.
When
anything gets started, anything that's super cutting edge and cool, it's going to be very expensive. And the people that go out and you know, buy the product or the service are generally going to be the, you know, top class of the society or whoever, you know, they have the cash. So what happens, though, is that it starts to catch on. And when it catches on, that's if it really is a good thing, it slowly but surely starts to become something that everybody does. And then the price does come down. But it's almost as if it has to go that route in order to be accepted as totally cool and really worth it.
Exactly. It's like people don't believe it until it's out there. It's $10,000 a week, and people are paying $10,000 a week to go get it. Then people say, I want to do that, and $10,000 is a little steep for me. And then there can be other places that stand up and say, oh, I'm a permaculture farm, and we only charge $4,000 a week. And, you know, then suddenly, hey, market. There's market for it.
Yep.
And there's value in it. And then people want it. Currently, people want a lawn because other people paid $1 million a year to have a lawn back in, you know, the equivalent of, I mean, basically, the idea was is that, what was it, 500 years ago in France, and they're saying, you know, look, I've got 400 servants dedicated with scissors out there trimming the lawn.
Right.
So that way, everybody else out there, all the neighbors, know I'm the richest dude on the block.
Right.
And so now we all have lawns because of that. It all started with the million-dollar lawn. And so we're all kind of emulating the million-dollar lawn, but for cheaper, on the cheap.
Yeah, it takes that to get people excited about developing that industry.
Exactly. So that's kind of where I'm going with this. And I'm kind of thinking, you know, if I can do this, that helps to set the pace. And so then so when I think about what I want to do, that's part of what I want to do. Plus, of course, you know, the whole idea of the Wafati, the whole idea of all these other projects that I want to do. And yet, you know what? I'm being so open about all this stuff. And it's like, you know, there's going to be somebody else that's going to say, I want to implement what Paul Wheaton said, and because I want to make $40 million a year. And it's like,
right,
please, please beat me to the punch. I'm begging you, beat me to the punch. That'll be awesome. Don't wait for me to blaze the trail first. You go for it. You create the Wafatis. You go ahead and do the $10,000 a week, you know, permaculture resort. You know, all those kinds of things. Yes, go for it. There is, I mean, in the HUSP podcast, in my HUSP article, the whole concept of like being able to draw a line around the Flathead Indian Reservation,
right?
And being able to say we don't allow any toxic gick in here, you know, and so we are now the biggest health resort in the United States. And we've got, you know, 87 different health resorts here. All the food is way beyond organic. All the food is HUSP food. All the food is like, you know, what if we took permaculture 400 years ago and evolved it up to now using all the best of modern techniques? You know, that kind of mentality, this kind of health mecca, based on this totally opposite direction of health, of like, you know, what if rather than fighting the problem, if we just boost the natural immune system and boost the general health, and then somebody's health becomes then so strong and vibrant that all the other stuff whittles away? It won't work for everybody, but I imagine it'll work for 90% of the people.
Right.
You know, and there's probably a lot of people out there that are on the edge of death that this will work for.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, most people. I mean, for sure. That video that you said that you wanted to do a podcast on, what is it called? Here it is, Alone in the Wilderness.
Oh, yeah.
I saw a little piece of that, you know, that's out on YouTube, and they were pointing out the fact that I can't remember his name. It's Dick.
Dick Prenicky.
That's right. Awesome dude. Never got sick the whole time he was out there.
Yeah. Weird, huh?
You know, just good exercise, eating good food, clean water, clean air.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing what that'll do for you, right?
I rest my case.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and so it just seems like, and I just, I, you know, so anyway, all right, so the point is Paul Wheaton is actually not doing it, therefore it's kind of hard to believe anything he has to say. I'm just here to say that is a very valid point. I agree with that. So then I have everything that I have to say. Some of the things I've tried, I think I try to qualify it, and some of the things, these are things that other people have tried and I've observed, and a lot of it is just my own pontification. And I think a lot of farmers, the best farmers out there are perpetually innovating and perpetually coming up with new ideas. And I hope that some of those farmers will hear my stuff and pick out one or two things and say that they're going to try that. Not because they think I'm necessarily right or whatever, but because I say something and it mixes into their head with the other things that are already in their head. And then based on that mixing comes up with a damn good idea that they'll go out and do. And so suddenly, you know, things move forward, damn it. And this is a lot of rambling from a giant doofus. What can I say? And I do believe that there are a very few people out there. There might be 10 people listening to this podcast right now that are just, you know, very well aligned with me, and just, you know, they are my people, and so this is really for them, those 10 people out there. And then there's a bunch of people that are out there listening and think, oh, I think this guy's full of shit. That's cool, man. And I'm not making this video or this podcast for you.
Right.
You can listen if you want. I don't care. So,
well, I appreciate all the new ideas. That's all I can tell you. I mean, I've tried a lot of what I've seen out there, and the first time I ever heard about most of this stuff was from permies.com. And so, hey, that alone, just getting that word out, just getting somebody to argue about it is enough.
There you go. I think that we're on to something. I think that uh, I I think we're changing things.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is last year in 2011, we had 5.7 million people come to my permaculture empire.
Wow.
And I believe that's 5.7 million people that I have now uttered the word permaculture to, and I think, and at the same time we're on the edge of, like, this month we might see a million people this month, and so we're looking at close to a million people per month for 2012, which would mean that by the end of 2012 that'll have been 12 million people. So I kind of think that, you know, we're making a difference, and so then, you know, it's hard to kind of stop doing that as long as, you know, people keep showing up. What should we do? Should I stop doing this?
Well, you're the only one thinking that you should, I believe, so.
Yeah, and it's kind of this painful thing. I really want to get back out there. And when people, you know, whenever anybody writes to me or whatever and says, dude, you're too fucking fat, you need to lose some weight. And it's kind of like, you know what? As soon as I got a farm under me, the weight will disappear. That's what happened last time. And it's like...
the farm
so
diet.
I agree. Yeah, basically, yeah. You get out there and you start working and it's like, next thing you know, it's like, huh, I lost 50 pounds.
Right, right.
You know, it's like there's just too many cool projects to do, and they all take, you know, physical effort. But I am getting older. It probably won't buzz away so quick. All right, we make the best of it. We do what we can. And I can't help but think that the farm is going to happen. And it's like, you know, I just don't have enough nickels saved up yet for a proper down payment either. So, we'll see. We'll see how things pan out. And I totally respect that I really have no right in the world to be talking about this. And at the same time, people seem to keep tuning in. So... let's make the best of it. All right, we're going to review this next bit of this book.
Right.
Sepp Holzer's Permaculture. We're on chapter... This is
chapter five, yeah.
It's the last chapter.
Right. Well, before chapter six.
There is no chapter six.
Chapter six is, unless you have the other version, projects.
Is that a chapter?
Well, maybe not. It says Scotland.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's got Thailand and...
it has the number six.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I thought that was like an appendix. All right.
No, he's kind of talking about some things. I think these are like projects that he got involved in other countries, which is really cool.
Right, right. Well, chapter six is like freaky short.
Right, it is.
Oh, all right. So this is the last bit from chapter... Well, we're in chapter five.
Right.
Let's just say that.
Right.
We're in chapter five. Helpers in the garden and regulating fellow creatures. That's right. What you do is you create a book of laws and then you put it out where all the bugs could see it.
Right. Well, you basically become a manager.
You tell them about the court system for your farm.
Right.
And, if you bugs commit these crimes and eat those plants, then, you know, jail time, you know.
They're using that word regulating because it's been such a big part of his life.
Maybe that's it.
He's like, oh, yeah, they're going to regulate me. I'm going to regulate you, okay?
So he starts off talking about aphids. And you know, I mean, we're getting towards the end of the book. And I kind of feel like it's less polished here than it was earlier in the book. And I kind of am feeling a little bit like, you know, we're getting towards the bits and bobs and what has he not mentioned so far. And when I read this part, it's kind of like it doesn't seem as profound as the earlier parts of the book. I mean, it seems like stuff I've heard a lot of times. But like he starts talking about aphids and different ideas on how to mitigate aphids. But it seems to me that when, like, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whenever it was, I was talking to him that he was in the United States, and I would talk to him about aphids, he kept coming back to how aphids play a critical role in nature. and you, you know, stop trying to get rid of aphids.
Well, I think his point here is that he's saying this is how you keep it from becoming an imbalance.
No, well, now let me finish this thought here.
Okay.
And you're right and all, but the thing is that from a few years ago when he would say this, basically the message he was conveying to me was stop trying to fight the aphids. Aphids play a critical role in nature. And then he would usually mention something about pine trees. And I just kind of felt that what he was saying was so profound that I was just stupid and I couldn't quite figure it out. So I've spent a huge amount of time trying to better understand that space. But he mentioned something about pine trees, and he also has mentioned a couple of things. Like there's something about, like, I think there's some kind of I can't remember what it is. It's an elm or an oak or something like that. But there's some tree where if you take the aphids away, the tree will die.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah.
There's all these different little scenarios that he's brought up where it's like, no, the aphids are an important part and you need to have them. And then the other thing is that when he sees a plant so covered with aphids that the plant is going to die, then the lessons that he draws from that are that, you know, okay, that plant did not do well there, and if he wants that plant to do well there, then he needs to let the plant die and change something there as far as like the polyculture or the diversity or the soil or the mulch or something, and then the plant would thrive there and not get aphids. But the fact that there's aphids there is indicative that he's done something wrong in the system. But at no point does he think, and this is what I thought years ago, at no point does he think, I need to get rid of the aphids. However, in what we just read, it was kind of like, here's how I get rid of the aphids.
You know,
and
I wonder if, you know, when he's talking about fruit trees and other large-scale things, that's his take on it. And then when he's in the garden section, which is this chapter, like, this is the smaller world. This is the urban gardening thing, and here's how you would control this because it's a smaller system. I'm just throwing that out there.
Well, we are talking about Zone 2.
Right.
And at no point in time does he mention Zone 1, Zone 2, Zone 3.
Right.
You know,
well, because this is SEPS permaculture. It's a different world.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And you know, this is one of the questions I've got lined up to ask him is like, okay, what is the difference between Holzer permaculture and permaculture? And I'm gonna ask him the question: have you, sir, ever taken a PDC? I imagine the answer is fuck no.
I was gonna say, I hope you have a crash helmet with you.
Yeah, I think wearing a helmet while I ask these questions may be wise.
And maybe putting it on right before answering the question will kind of, like, you know, soften him up a little too.
maybe I should make sure also that he is tied to a tree so he can't, like, leave or something. I don't know.
Or hold one of those cast iron pots up between the two of you then.
Yeah, and so I don't know, but it's I believe the answer is going to be, you know, no, he's not taking the PDC, but I am kind of curious as like, you know, is he familiar with the whole Zone 1, Zone 2 stuff, I'm kind of curious, like, what would be his response to the three ethics?
Well, if nothing else, just so that he can relate to the people who are, you know, diving into permaculture through a PDC.
True, true, yeah. And so then they've taken a PDC, and so then he can use this language, perhaps, to talk to them, maybe. But it does seem like he has a different way of going about a lot of this stuff. And I do think I do like that he's okay with calling it permaculture. I thought he may have abandoned the word. I know that that years ago when I saw him, he was calling it Holzer's permaculture, and he was very emphatic that this is not permaculture, this is Holzer permaculture.
Right.
And I'd heard, about a year after that, I'd heard, and I didn't verify, that he had dropped the word permaculture altogether. But then, you know, it was about, what was it, 6 months ago, a year ago, that this book came out. And it says Sepp Holzer's permaculture, in which case it kind of gives you the idea that he hasn't dropped the word.
You know, it's it was interesting on the podcast that you talked about possibly getting away from the word permaculture, because it started to feel a little like it had been maybe, I'm going to use the word, co-opted by the wrong sort. But I think what happens is as people like Jeff Lawton put out another DVD and amazes the world, and or something else happens where permaculture just starts to feel like a real professional, awesome thing, that, you know, I could see people changing their minds. I mean, you know, you were talking about Helen Attow, and I just, by the way, listened to Eco Farm this morning, and that was an awesome podcast. But yeah, she's got veganicpermaculture.com now. I think your influence on these people is pretty intense.
This is a few people. I mean, what about Darren Doherty? I mean, he's going with carbon farming. Is he going to come back to the word permaculture ever? Maybe he will. But it's like, and then as far as co-opting the word permaculture, you know, by these other people, I kind of think that there's room under the permaculture umbrella for all of us. And, But I kind of feel like at the same time that a lot of these other folks are saying there's room under the permaculture umbrella for all of us, and Paul Wheaton has to get the fuck out from under the umbrella, and Sepp Holzer has to go, and that guy over there, he has to go. That's not permaculture, buddy. And so that kind of stuff. And so and I kind of refer to this as the hate in the name of love group,
right?
And I kind of feel like let's all be under the umbrella together, and it's like, but I am concerned that the people that are serious about farming and serious about, and they're not into the hearts and flowers and rainbows, I think there's room under the umbrella for them too. For the people that are like, you know, into farming, it's their livelihood and their income, and they're not going to do the drums and and they're not going to sing the songs and they listen to Rush Limbaugh. I think that there's room under the umbrella for people who watch Fox News. I like the idea that they do permaculture too, and they continue to watch Fox News. They can go for it. That's their right.
You know, I suppose that's true. So.
I want to see things get better. I want to see things be less toxic. And I think I like the, and I think that there is a path out there where, and I've mentioned this a few times in my podcast before, I like the idea that one day you'll go into Safeway, all the food in Safeway is permaculture food, and it got that way not because Safeway is on an eco kick, but it got that way because the farmers just made more money doing things the permaculture way than doing it the Monsanto way.
Well, right, which meant there was a demand for it. There was education, people understood what was going on, and then there was a demand for it, and the farmers were there to fill that demand.
Well, I think, rather than demand, I think that there was apathy for it. There was apathy from the consumers, just as there's apathy now. The apathy was still there. The consumers still didn't give a shit. And at the same time, the farmers kind of went from like, wow, I've got 10,000 acres and I make $14,000 a year. And they kind of thought to themselves, you know, or I could have 500 acres and I make $500,000 a year.
Right. Well, you know, that's a good point. I think, though, that the farmers would probably not call it permaculture food, and it would just be marked as regular food.
Which is okay with me.
Yeah, which, you know, I agree too. That's sort of like working it from both ends. If people are educated enough on one end and then the farmers are trying to save some money and figure out a better way, then, yeah, you'll take the world by storm.
I, as much as it's fun to talk about my evil empire and world domination, and really it's like if these guys just get the idea that they're going to make more money by doing these techniques, and then they leave the word permaculture out and they leave me out of it and everything like that, I am totally okay with that.
Right.
And at the same time, I kind of feel like, how do we, get the word out enough that they can have the idea to do this?
It's my impression that you just have to have examples like Sepp Holzer.
I like the idea, because when people will point to Sepp Holzer and say, yeah, but he's not in the United States. Therefore, he's like living some sort of charmed super life over there because government, not our government.
Right.
And of course, it's like, they've got the same kinds of problems over there, but it's like, it's like they just can't seem to believe it.
Right.
And it's like every time we have an example of everything being awesome, they'll find a reason why they can't believe that.
Right.
And therefore it's like they'll find a reason within 30 seconds why they can't believe it, and therefore they don't even look at the rest of the picture. So I do think you're right. We need more examples.
Right. Well, I think, like, if you walk around in the modern American life and you're being marketed to and basically lied to so often, I do not blame people for being, like, almost irrationally you get where I'm coming from, like, irrationally skeptical about anything, no matter how awesome it looks. Especially, actually, the more awesome it is, the more skeptical they become.
True. Oh, yeah. If it was that good, people would be doing it now.
Oh, exactly. So, yeah, more. You have to have two or three here, and then it'll start to take off. What is that they say? If you can affect a certain percentage of the population, it hits critical mass and then takes off.
Oh, I think that there's truth to that too. And then, of course, whoever were the early adopters, they get what? What is the word? Fucking rich?
Well, true.
I can't remember.
Or they go insane and somebody else steals the idea. But yes.
Yeah. Well, that's true too. I mean, the first four or five people that do it, I think that they get burned at the stake.
Yeah. Oh, even the Tesla.
And then the people after that get rich.
Even in Tesla, it turns out the guy that owns it now actually got the idea from another guy and they pushed him out.
the big business stuff. It is a very complicated world, and there's so much going on. And that's right. Now we've talked about the bigger business stuff, and now it made me think of something I saw today. I got an email from ATRA. Which is NCAT, the National Center for Appropriate Technology. And they've got a lot of cool stuff going on there, no doubt. And they've got 200 employees. And basically, here's this is so rude of me. I am such a rude guy. And I've talked to some of these people, and they are lovely, lovely people. But basically, here is my analysis. They do what I do, but it takes 200 of them.
Right.
And they've got a budget. Those people are getting paid to do it. I'm not.
Well, I mean, now you got to figure out what they're doing.
Well, they get grants is what it is. So I know that a while ago they were like saying, help us get funded and stuff. But then they sent this email out today about how they're helping people to get certified in the energy certification. Like, you can go around to houses and tell them to buy fluorescent light bulbs and make their house more of a Ziploc bag to keep the warmth in, and super good sense, or no, that wasn't it. It was something else. It's like the when you go and you buy an appliance and it has a sticker on it that says this is an energy efficient appliance.
Energy Star.
So they're doing Energy Star for homes, and they want to help train people to be able to go out and give the Energy Star certification for homes, and like that will be their job. And it's like they're 30% more efficient than most homes is the idea.
Right.
And I was like, I went out and I looked through some stuff about that, and it's like, oh, this just gives me a stomachache.
I hear you.
And it's like, NCAT Dear Incat Atra, here's what I'd really like for you to do. I'd like for you to advocate things that are like way beyond that. And as opposed to like, you know, here's how you get to qualify for this. Have a lot more insulation.
I know. You know the thing about it is, and there's nothing wrong with that stuff. But
if you buy more of what's out there and you buy some fluorescent light bulbs.
Right.
Then we're going to give you this special label of awesome.
Right.
And I kind of think to myself, like, I don't know, I want Atra to spread the good word of, like, how about Art Ludwig? How about if they go out and say, if you have a smaller home, that's one way of being more efficient. Or if you have a large home but it's designed to be multi-families under one roof, sharing a kitchen, that would be a good design. That would, like, cut your footprint in half. Or even rocket mass heaters, Wafati, you know, any of this kind of stuff.
So, Paul?
But, yes.
As you were going down that list, I was thinking hippie. And by the way, I love that. But my point is it seems like everything that gets funded and everything that gets put out in front of your face, if you go down the list of what it is, it's all you buying something from somebody every single time.
See, now that's the thing. That's the thing that was really bothering me, is it's like if you spend more, then you get this green star of approval.
Right.
And it's like, oh, stomach ache.
Well, yeah. You know? And so you're using 30% less electricity, and then they're going to charge you 30% more in about 5 or so years.
Something like that. So I just kind of feel like, okay, maybe I'm a dirty, stinky hippie. And, of course, we talked earlier. Turns out we don't stink anymore,
no.
It turns out.
Yeah.
But you know, and we are clean. We shower every day.
Right. Sometimes twice. You got to realize I'm in the middle of Florida.
I do. I mean, I came from the corporate whore world where, you know, we go into work every day and, you know, looking like a hippie is not okay. And so the idea was to be professional, including in how you appeared. And granted, I'm glad that I don't, you know, put on that outfit every day anymore. That I'm glad that now I do put on overalls every day.
Right.
But at the same time, I do feel like this information is good to get out to the people that, you know, are not the hippies, and to get out to the general public. And I don't know how to do that. Atra does seem to have a channel into that, but they seem to want to convey this far more conventional thing. They want to convey conventional organic to their audience, which kind of seems like, I can't help but think that the audience would be kind of like, yawn. But I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about it. But you're saying, as I'm rolling these things off, you're thinking hippie, hippie, hippie. And I'm thinking, all right, I want to be able to say rocket mass heater and have people think, yeah, that's that new way of heating your home that's so much cheaper. We should be doing more of that because I like to have my money in my pockets for my hookers, heroin, and hooch.
Right.
Or whatever it is that they spend their money on.
Right.
And you know, or now I don't have to go out and get as much money or whatever.
Which, by the way, this is a time in our economy.
For the future. I think that's a good one. Everybody wants to buy a home. Why do they want to buy a home instead of rent? For the safety. Because one day it's paid off, and then they have less financial burden. They can effectively retire. I think that these are noble goals, and I like the idea that this idea isn't. Now, granted, I'd like to be able to see more rocket mass heaters developed that are going to be like something that's more conventionally acceptable.
Right.
You know, something that's going to have a look that's like, ooh, this one's beautiful. I like this one.
A stainless steel barrel.
And you know what? It doesn't have to be a barrel. It could be a bell. I've seen rocket mass heaters where they have had custom made bells.
Nice.
Instead of a barrel. So basically the barrel is a cheap bell.
Right.
And so we need the Tesla of the rocket mass heaters. And we need a few of them. Now, I do think that Ernie and Erica, there's a picture. If you go to permies.com/stoves, I think I set it up as permies.com/stoves.
Right.
There's a picture there of a gorgeous rocket mass heater. It is a piece of art. It is amazingly beautiful. And I think that this thing can help blaze the way for people to be more accepting of rocket mass heaters. So for all of these ideas, for Sepp Holzer's stuff, for the Wafati, for all of these things, I just kind of want to see it, you know, move more into the mainstream. And then on top of that, and you know what? You know who would be awesome at getting this into the mainstream? Would be NCAT and ATRA. They got 200 employees for crying out loud.
Right. So I see the lady with the that you were telling me about that has the piping, the copper piping around the barrel.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That's Tina.
That's a good one. Well, you know, and she's in the bathtub and she's in a yurt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the thing is that that is the whole trick. The whole trick is, how do you make this stuff sexy?
Well, I think a big part of it is the Tesla effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're not talking about Nikola Tesla. We're talking about the Tesla car.
Right.
It's like somebody's got to come out and say, "I'll put a rocket mass heater in your house for $100,000."
But in this case, it would be an electric rocket mass heater. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Yay! Oh, okay.
Boo. I think right now we're saying, okay, it seems like the average price that people are paying for a rocket mass heater is like $200, and they take a weekend to put them together. And it just seems like, you know, what would be great is to have some getting installed where people are dropping $10,000 on them to get installed, and they are a big piece of magnificent art. You know,
right.
and then let's get more examples of that going on.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, all right. Hey, we're going to talk about this book. We are talking about this book.
What book?
Because we're talking about Helpers in the Garden and Regulating Fellow Creatures. And the point I was trying to make was that the whole thing with the aphids. That's where we got started with this.
Oh, right.
And there's some different schools of thought about aphids.
Very good.
And so then. We've got what we're seeing here is like, okay, you got aphids, you want to get rid of aphids, here's some tips on how to get rid of aphids. And I was kind of thinking, like, where's the detailed part that he was saying a few years ago to me about, no, you know, when you feel the need to get rid of aphids, the problem is within yourself.
Right, right.
Where's that message?
Then you have failed.
What? I'm trying to, like, am I reading this wrong? Am I holding it upside down? What is it? You know, do I have to read it backwards and then there's the message? I don't get it. And so I did not see that. Did you see that message in there?
I didn't see it.
Yeah. So then I'm kind of thinking, like, well, what is this? Is this like for the fourth chapter? Maybe somebody else wrote this.
Yeah, I was just thinking, aphids, luckily I don't have a problem with aphids, but I do the next section with voles.
All right. I marked off some stuff about voles.
Yeah.
Because I thought the voles made a good example of what I think is kind of a Holzer-esque message about these kinds of things. So now, granted, he didn't also talk about moles, because usually when I've heard him in the past talk about voles, he'll say voles and moles, and the first message that I've heard him say in the past, which does not appear in here, is like, well, if you've got voles and moles, then you know. Clearly, you need to be putting more. You don't have your pigs in there often enough,
right?
You know, that's pig food on the hoof, and it doesn't say that in here. So here's what it does say: the voles also take many pieces of root away and store them for the winter, or feed them to their young. However, they regularly lose individual pieces of root in their extensive network of tunnels. These tunnels are collapsed by rain. Or are colonized by other animals, and the voles must rebuild them. The lost salsify, black salsify, Jerusalem artichoke, and carrot roots, to name a few, begin to sprout in the tunnels, and new plants develop in the most unlikely places and the most inhospitable areas. These are frequently places where you would never have thought to plant anything. The tunnels themselves drain off excess water and aerate the soil. If I let the voles work for me, I will have aerated, loose, and well-drained soil, and also lush, diverse vegetation. The vole will no longer appear as a cause of damage. It is important to make sure that there are always enough decoy plants available to them. Decoy plants are particularly tasty plants which the animals prefer to eat. Jerusalem artichoke and black salsify make very good decoy plants. If there are enough available, the voles will leave the fruit trees alone. All right. I think there's a lot more to say about this that isn't written here. Like snakes. There's no mention of snakes. Or other predators. Other vole predators. Like once you have a lot of voles, and this is something that Toby Hemingway goes into a lot of detail with. Once you have enough voles, you're going to have lots of vole predators show up. And then, your general overall vole count is kept in check. He did say something weird about how voles are a territorial animal. And then if you get rid of one vole, you'll just have another vole move in, which is kind of like the whole thing I do when I talk about raccoons when you're talking about predator control with chickens. It's like it's kind of pointless to kill a raccoon.
Right.
But when you're in an urban area. But when you're in a rural area, then having predators eat your voles is totally okay. And by predators, I think I would much rather have the pigs eat the voles than anything else.
And the pigs do eat the voles, huh?
Oh, yeah.
They're little fuzzy guys. They're so cute.
That's true enough. At the same time, the pigs think they're tasty.
Yeah, that's right.
So, all right. And then he goes on talking about slugs and snails. And, of course, Mollison is famous for saying something about, you don't have a slug problem, you have a duck deficiency problem.
Right.
Something like that. You don't have an excess of slugs, you have a deficiency of ducks. Something like that.
Right.
That didn't appear either. And in fact, his solutions for slugs seemed kind of labor intensive, which made me think that these are like zone one, zone two things.
And this whole section probably is geared to zone one and zone two.
And then we got into earthworms. And the thing that I expected him to talk about in the earthworms was the thing that he said years ago, where he has never brought lime onto his land. And that whenever his soil is too acidic, that what he does is he brings in a certain variety of earthworm, which he breeds, and that earthworm goes deep into the soil and finds a lot of calcium down deep and brings it back up to the surface. And then that is how he repairs low pH soil instead of bringing in lime, which I thought was awesome, but is not mentioned in this book when he talks about earthworms. He does talk about how he breeds earthworms, and we haven't quite finished the book, but I was kind of hoping that this book was going to mention a few other things that he mentioned a few years ago. Like how he does not transplant.
Gotcha.
I mean, did we read anything in this book about transplanting and not transplanting? I don't remember anything. I mean, he transplants trees.
Yeah, he does talk about transplanting trees, but not about transplanting anything else.
But my impression is he, all the tomatoes that he grows are basically all volunteers. And he might put some seeds out once in a while, but he doesn't start them indoors. He doesn't start... My impression is, and the book doesn't verify or deny this, and this is what he said years ago, he does not start anything indoors anymore, or in a greenhouse. And the only thing he uses his greenhouse for is breeding earthworms. So, he doesn't start broccoli indoors and transplant it outside. He doesn't start tomatoes indoors and transplant them outside. He doesn't start anything indoors or peppers indoors and start them outside. It's just everything. It's like you either put the seed directly in the soil outside or you rely entirely on volunteers.
Which is kind of the same thing, but yeah.
But no mention in the book. No mention. All right, so here's what I did, Mark, out of the earthworm stuff. Brandling worms are epigeal, i.e., they live on the soil surface. Red earthworms, on the other hand, only spend their youth on the surface, and later they burrow into the deeper soil layers. Finally, common earthworms, which many think of as typical earthworms, create burrows to live in and search for food at depths of up to 3 meters. That's 10 feet deep.
That's quite amazing.
Especially when you consider that where he is, way up on the in the Alps there, 10 feet deep. That is awesome.
Right.
And I kind of think of, like, when we think of soil structure and soil tilth and things of that nature and what makes for good soil and why we don't want to till the soil, part of what pops into my head are all the little tunnels made by the earthworms.
Right.
And as soon as you start digging into the soil or tilling, then you destroy that tilth, that soil structure, and part of which is those earthworm tubes all over the place. So, these worms that go down to 10 feet deep and come back up, maybe those are the earthworms that are bringing the calcium up.
And I'm believing that these earthworms wouldn't go 10 feet down unless there was actual soil with organic matter 10 feet down. Or is this they're actually going through something the equivalent of, like, sand?
I don't know. I'm guessing that they're going 10 feet down and spending a lot of time down there, and that the things that they want are not organic matter. I mean, my impression is earthworms, the thing that they enjoyed eating the most is the organic matter. On the other hand, it's like, I don't know, I imagine the first foot of soil, there's a lot of activity in the soil. There's a lot of microbials and macrobials in that layer of soil. I do know that, like, I remember in the garden that I did around 2007 or so out at Green Lake, I put a lot of hay into the soil and then used a lot of hay mulch, doing a lot of the Ruth Stout method. And then I put down some of that fungal stuff that's supposed to, like, help build your soil and everything. And, man, there was, like, this, you know, there's fungus everywhere, this white, thick fungal stuff everywhere. And the earthworms got to be monster-sized. I mean, like, a foot and a half long.
Whoa.
They were huge. I'll bet you that there were, if I looked around, I know I took a picture of one that was like the most giant one I've ever seen, and I think it could have possibly been 2 feet long.
Wow.
Yeah. So these giant, giant earthworms. And then, like, a month later, I kept coming across all these earthworm carcasses, and it was rove beetles. These rove beetles were, like, were pulling up the earthworms, and it's like the earthworm looked like there'd been a drive-by shooting or something.
Oh, no.
And or a drive-by knifing. And they're like all kind of, like, you know, cut into segments looking like thing, only not cut all the way through, you know. So and I found the rove beetles at them, chomping at these half chewed up earthworms that were still alive. And so maybe the reason why they go down so deep is to get away from the, you know, things like rove beetles and robins. It's fucking robins.
Wow. You know, I have rats that dig up my garden, and they're going after, and everybody says, no, those are squirrels. It happens in the middle of the night when no one's looking, and they're going after my earthworms.
Ah, so then maybe that's why they go down so deep.
I hope so. Yeah, rats tore into, I used to have a worm tower. I had a couple of them out there with red wigglers in there, and the rats dug, you know, chewed through the plastic and got in there and just decimated it.
All right. Well,
so, yeah.
There's got to be a silver lining in that scenario somewhere.
I don't know. Everything wants to eat earthworms, I guess.
Maybe you need a new puppy, like a rat terrier.
Yeah. I was thinking that.
What is the word rat right in the rat terrier?
I know. Well, I was listening to a podcast you had on about how to protect chickens and things, and you were talking about the Great Pyrenees, and then I thought, well, that might be a bit large for me, but a rat terrier, that's the big deal. Yeah, that could be good.
Yeah, you know, and if you got a lot of rats, then you don't need a lot of dog food, do you?
Ah, that's true. Hey, going out there, buddy, eat up.
Yeah, it turns out we got all the dog food you need.
That's right.
All right, the next part in the earthworm section. Earthworm casts contain much more than plant nutrients, nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, and calcium that can be found in the best garden soil. All right, that's all I got marked off for that section. But it does, it kind of comes back. I know I marked it off with the idea of like trying to remind me about the calcium part, that you know, that could be the part that's shifting the pH. They'll go down deep, they'll get all this calcium, they'll bring it up and, you know, leave it at the surface, so that way the pH goes up. You know, for acidic soils, they get to be mended.
Right.
So now I'm looking to see what else I've marked off. I've got nothing else marked off in this section. That was it.
Right. Well, you know, the next part.
We're talking about kids.
Yeah, the next part's the stuff that you kind of gloss over, which is all the peachy, warm, and fuzzy stuff.
I know that. I mean, Sep is bonkers about children, and he reminisces about his own childhood so much, and he is utterly passionate that all children everywhere need to grow up on the farm with a garden. And you know, I naturally, as a guy that's bonkers about horticulture, I have to agree with him.
Right, me too.
And of course, you know, I also know that that probably isn't going to happen as much as I want. But it kind of comes back to the whole thing. Like when Sep doesn't want to answer your question, he says, "You must read from the book of nature." I think a lot of it is the reason why he's such a genius is that he did grow up with this stuff. And it does seem like if you grow up with this stuff, then it's going to be a lot easier to digest. Now, part of my years growing up, and I had this crazy ass childhood, but during part of the years I was growing up on a ranch.
Wow.
So I feel very fortunate for that, because I did learn a lot of this stuff there, and I did get to see a lot of things, and I did get to participate in a lot of things that still stick in my head that are important. And then as a teenager, I drove combine and pea swather and stuff like that. And so I got a lot of experience, a lot of different harvests, but those were all commodity crop kind of things. But at least I got to have that experience. So it you know, adds in something now. And I would imagine that very few people ever get the chance to drive a combine. But if you ever get a chance to drive a track hoe, you got to do that. That's like the coolest thing in the world.
Which one is the track hoe?
It's the thing where you've got the huge tracks on it, you know, like tank tracks.
Right.
But it's not the giant digger on it, you know, with the bucket. It's got the big arm that sticks out with a bucket on the end to dig.
Okay, all right.
You know what a backhoe is, right?
Yes.
Okay, so the backhoe, you got the digger on the back of the tractor or on the back of the contraption.
Right.
But a track hoe has the same kind of digger, but that's all it is.
Okay.
And then it'll spin on the tracks. Those things are just fun to drive. That's all I'm saying. They're fun to drive. And, of course, the you know, all of the Sep Holzer land sculpting stuff is, like, best done with a track hoe.
Okay. Now, I just looked it up, and this is what I've always been calling a backhoe. So, no, a backhoe is totally different. It's got a scoop in the front and a hoe thing in the back. But the track hoe, okay, I gotcha. All right.
Yeah. So the track hoe will spin, the backhoe won't spin.
Right.
Yeah. So the track hoes are just awesome to drive. And so go build some ponds, build some terraces.
Yeah.
Build some of these Holzer-style shelters, maybe a wafati, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Right. That is the tool to have.
Party on. Knock yourself
Party
out.
On.
They're cool. So, so lots of stuff about kids, and it does seem like, I would imagine teaching permaculture to kids that grew up with permaculture will be like 1,000 times easier.
Right.
And then the Book of Nature will be so much easier to read. And, you know, and as I pointed out to Sep, is that, Sep, I must be too stupid to be able to read the Book of Nature. Can you please read it for me?
Right.
Where he just laughs and moves on.
Right.
So, I need to get me one of those books, I guess.
Yeah, like, you know, show me where I can check that one out.
I went to the library. They didn't have it.
I kept asking.
Who is the author? God.
Oh, jeez. Oh my! So I have to die to get to that library. Oh yeah. Oh jeez. Yeah.
Look, it's in under G.
Under G.
Yeah. So, all right, that's all I got. You got anything else for this little tidbit? I mean, we rambled on about a lot of other things.
Oh, yeah, that was fun. No, I consider this – I do see where you say that maybe a lot of things are being left out on this chapter, and it's possible that for the interest of space, the editors chopped out a whole lot, or maybe even Sep decided to omit it. I don't know. But it does seem like – you know, like at the end of a movie where all of a sudden they just try to race to the conclusion. That's kind of what I feel like is going on here. And like with all those details that you're pointing out that aren't in here, that would be the stuff to find in this book. I agree.
Maybe the message was like he got about halfway through the book and then the rest of it could use some more polish and then he's like, "Ah, it's good enough. Ship it."
Right. that's the way it seems, yes.
Which, you know, actually I think is okay because if he was still, you know, otherwise he might spend the next 5 years still polishing it and we wouldn't have it at all.
True.
And I do think that this book is critically important. You know, it's kind of like I don't think there's so much stuff that's in this book that's just not in any of the others.
Agreed. Yeah, definitely. So it's nice to have his point of view or not even his point of view on this. It's more like now you get to see permaculture from Sep Holzer's angle. And so all the information you have in your head now is just augmented by this.
To me, when I look at the book, so now we're almost done with the book. We'll probably finish the next podcast. We'll be done with the book. I'm guessing.
Right.
But to me, it's like this is a postcard from the Kramerhof.
Right. I got you.
And so I kind of feel like the depth of what's really going on there is probably about 400 times greater than this book. I mean, like, we really didn't... He does a lot of breeding of fish that's, like, really astounding. I don't remember talking about that very much. I mean, there's just so much more going on there. But I think that there's like the most important stuff for changing the world for other people to do at home is covered in this book.
True.
So I do think that there's so much more going on, and I do hope that it gets, you know, all documented and everything. Yeah. And you know, part of it is I think he's in his 70s now. Hopefully there'll be like, you know, 15 or 20 more movies made out of this place. Maybe stuff that's like, you know, got a lot more depth to it.
That's true. And, you know, didn't you say that it was his children that actually motivated him to even put the book out?
My impression is that he wrote this book in German many years ago. So the book's been available in German for like, I don't know, 10 years or something.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And now his kids, I think, helped with the translation.
Gotcha.
As far as motivate, my impression is motivation probably came from Maddie Harland.
Oh, okay.
That would be my motivation for the translation.
Right.
Would be my guess. I'm not really sure. But I do know that years ago I was told that the book was being translated, but I heard through the grapevine that original translation like never got finished or something. And so I think that this is like this one got started a year before the book was actually put out. So it's like, you know, a more recent translation.
Right.
Is my guess, from what little I know, that's a lot of guessing.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I know I'm going to be doing a podcast soon with Maddie Harlan. Maybe I'll have to ask her that. You know, how did you crack the whip over Sepulter?
Right, yeah, really.
To get the English translation done or something
well,
like that.
Well, one thing's for certain, once you read this book, I bet you you're going to at least start putting away money to go visit the Kramaderhof. I mean, it's like, man, I've got to go see this.
Yeah, I think about that a lot, like, should I go? And part of me thinks, if you go to Sepulter's place, then apparently 5 hours away from Sepulcher's place is Damanhur. And so, you know, twofer. And on top of that, you know, stop off in England and say howdy to Maddie Harlan.
I've never heard of this other place. What was it called?
Damanhur?
Damanhur? No, I haven't heard of that.
I haven't mentioned that in a podcast?
I don't think so.
So, this is. I'll go ahead and do it. What the hell? It's my podcast. I can do whatever the hell I want.
You go.
Yeah. Damn right. Damn Skippy.
Right.
Okay. So, so it's a community. It's an intentional community. They've got like 900 people living there now. And so my impression is that it goes kind of like this. It's like 20, 25 years ago, there's this dude, and he is big on, like, energy paths across the world. And I don't know what that even means, like what an energy path is. But this is what he's saying. There's energy paths across the world. And wherever there are two or more energy paths that cross, usually three, then there's like one of the seven wonders of the world.
Oh, interesting.
And it's like, you know, so whoever's like, you know, hooking up to this vibe is like, you know, catching up to this. So then he found this spot in Italy where six of them cross. And it was like slightly underground. And on a mountainside. So there's this mountain, and if you go like, I think it's like 50 feet or 80 feet into the mountain is where these six energy paths cross. So, maybe the guy's a nut. But on the other hand, this nut starts digging there to get at it. And then he's got some friends. You know, of course, first they buy the land. And because the land was for sale. Yay.
That is nice.
Got that worked out. And then they start digging in to get to where these energy paths are crossing. And I have no idea how you can even tell that there are energy paths or whatever. I don't know. I don't care. I don't care. Thing is, he believes that they're there. And that there are six of them. And he's got the worldwide gold mine on energy paths. And so he's going to dig down to where they are. And he's got a bunch of friends that believe in him, and so then there they are in the middle of nowhere digging holes. And so they get to this place, and ooh, it's awesome. So they start creating something temple-ish, shrine-ish, something like awesome. And by this time, other people are coming to bask in the awesomeness, and then the government finds out,
uh-oh.
and says, "Thou shalt not." So they put the kibosh on it, and then they went and scratched their chins and came back and said, "You know, this seems like it could be a tourist attraction, and we like tourists coming here and parting with their dough."
Right.
We've decided to allow you to continue your crazy stuff.
And how do you spell this? Is it Damanhur?
Crazystuff.
Right. Gotcha.
Okay, so Damanhur, Damanhur. I'm looking at the book. They've got coffee table book.
Right. I just wanted to make sure I was at the right place. I found it online.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So they somehow the people who start coming and hanging out with them are like these amazing super artists and engineers, and you know that people that are kind of like the life they had before was common, and they, you know, come to Dominhur and their life is magnificent and awesome. And so now, instead of using their talents in the outer world, they have to be in Dominhur. And where what they do is they express their engineering skills and their artistic skills and all this stuff as art. And so this coffee table book has the pictures of their temples and whatnot that they've made. And they're kind of like in this space of like, you know, they're open to all religions and they're open to all this stuff and they're open to all this good vibery stuff. And so when they say temple, it's not like a temple for this religion or that religion or anything like that. I don't know. The book says temples of humankind, whatever that might mean. And so I kind of don't want to like get people to get the idea that like there's some sort of culty thing going on there. I think it's like everybody who comes there generally is signed up for some spiritual package, whether it's, you know, Christianity or Buddhism or whatever. You know, and so it's kind of like that. All these people are powerfully spiritual folks, but the most important thing is the art. The art is stunning, is amazing, and it's just awesome. And then 900 people living together. I'm sure by now it's probably more than 900. And when they all live in houses, and each house contains 20 people. And so then there's this whole idea of like, how do 20 people live under one roof without stabbing each other? And it's like they've got systems that work very well.
Wow.
And it is not a consensus-based system. And they've got a lot of fabulous ideas. So anyway, I've met people that have gone there and come back, and they're like all starry-eyed and like, whoa.
Wow.
And it's kind of like there's a lot of people that go there and don't ever come back. You know, yep, stay in.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at the book and I see what you mean by the artwork. Some of this, there's just one little page open on this book, and that right there is insane.
Yeah. The book is kind of like one of those things where you get the book and then you just turn the pages and you are glued to this book for an hour, and then it does do good things for your innards, just staring at these pages like, whoa. And then you kind of think about, they kind of dug the whole thing by hand. And it's like these rooms are immense, and it's got pictures of them with like each of them holding a 5-gallon bucket.
Wow.
Got their picks, you know, and it's kind of like, jeez, that's, you know. So we're talking about on the scale of the pyramids kind of a thing, which, by the way, that's where three energy fields cross, is where the pyramids are.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's a pyramid or what, but. But the other thing is that like this book is now kind of old, and they've been still going at it ever since with even more people. So, you know, wow, what kinds of new amazing art have they done now? And I don't know, it just kind of seems like a place to go and bask in the glow of art and artisans and so if you're gonna go to Sepp's place, swing by Dominhur.
Right, you know? Right, wow.
And you know, as long as you're in Europe, I can't help but think that I would want to, you know, because I can think of probably 20 places I would want to go and check out in Europe that have to do with permaculture. You know, I'd like to go by Portugal to that Tamanara or whatever it was, the place where Sepp has gone and Seppified it, you know.
Oh, wow.
And I'd like to go check that out, see what it's like. and you know, see for myself. I'd also like to go to England. You know, if I go to England, I want to go. I want to go and shake Ben Law's hand. That guy is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Man, his stuff is so good. And I want to see his stuff. I want to see his place. I want to, you know, and that's another thing. Green woodworking. I would really like to gain some experience in green woodworking. And I just haven't seemed to caught any of that going on in the United States. But they're doing it all the damn time in England.
So it sounds like you're about to take a European tour.
Well, I've never gotten a passport, and then every time I go and I get the passport form, I think to myself, one of these days I'm going to go see Sepp's place. So I'm going to go get the passport form, and then I get the passport form, and I'm looking at it, and I'm reading all the questions, and it's like, fuck that.
Right. You know, it used to be much easier.
Yeah, exactly. And so then it's this ongoing back and forth thing. It's like, I'm going to do it. And then I look at the form and it's like, no, I am not.
Right.
So that seems to be my biggest hurdle right now.
Right.
just the willingness to fill out that form.
Well, you know, if you stack up enough things, that might push you over the edge. You know, this Diamondhoer thing is fantastic. I've never even heard of it before.
Pretty powerful,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, there's tons and tons and tons of other stuff going on in Europe, of course. There's those places where, like, it's a kibbutz, where I was reading about one where it was like this abandoned all-stone village. And no one had lived in it for I don't know how many years. And then they kind of had a bunch of people go back, and they're kind of rebuilding it and getting it back into functioning order and living there again. And it just seems like it just – from what I read of it, it just sounded really, really cool, and I would like to just see it. So there's that. What about the deserts of Spain where Sepp did some stuff? Where he brought back lakes.
I love that story.
Yeah, I would like to see those lakes. I would like to see the oak trees there, which are apparently near death. I'd like to see the garden that he built there with dominantly hugelkultur. I just would like to see these things. Not to mention, like, you know, of course, we hear all the stuff about Sepp's Fountain of Youth water.
Right.
And, you know, I'm a little older.
Right.
So I would like to feel that. I'd like to experience that. And not to mention, I bet you I could easily, you know, pester the hell out of Sepp for a month on his property about every little stupid detail there.
Yeah, I could see him buying you the plane ticket back.
Yeah. There's that picture of me and Sepp where Sepp's kind of riding in my right armpit.
Right.
And you can kind of read the expression on his face, like, I'm getting pretty sick of this guy. You can kind of tell this kind of fake smile he's got on, like,
I didn't sign up for this.
Yeah. That was the day that that Sepp had come to me, and he points at himself and he goes, Elka, and then he points at me and he says, Elefanta. Yes, I am a fat bastard.
Oh, no, he meant large.
So there's lots of stuff there to see at Sepp's place, and there's got to be tons and tons of other stuff. I keep putting it out of my mind because it's like, oh, I'm not going over to Europe. I'm never going over there. No, but when I talk to Maddie, of course, has a list, and she's like, you know, come on over, and here's all the things we're gonna go do.
Oh, let me tell you, you've got to spend a lot of time in England. Because there is so much over there.
I'd love to go and participate in the proper construction of a proper hedge.
Oh, yeah, yeah. By the way, one of those...
Great is to do one that's a polyculture hedge, because all the hedges that they do are all a monocrop hedge. They're all the same species. It would be great to be someplace where it's like, they've planned ahead, and like 8 years ago, they planted this polyculture hedge of like, you know, 20 different species of stuff.
Right.
And now, because what you got to do is you got to let them grow straight up for a while. And then you make them into a hedge where you come and you kind of, you know, hit them with the billhook?
The billhook.
Knot, and then you bend it over, and it's a coppicing species, and then you kind of weave it all in, and then they're all kind of laying into the next one kind of a thing. And so that, but with not just one species, but with like 12 different species.
Right. I've seen some of that. Is that what Maddie does?
I don't know. I don't know if she does that.
Oh.
I just know that in England is where they do a lot of that.
Right.
And I would just like to be part of some place where they're like really doing it and really doing it right, because I understand that's what, you know, they've got like several different ways of hedging.
Sure. I mean, that's supposed to be like, that was one person's entire occupation.
Yeah.
You were the hedger, you know?
Yeah. So there are things that seem to be going on there that aren't really going on here, and I'd if they are going on here, then I'd like to hear about it. And if it is something that is something like it's probably the only one of its kind going on in the nation, I hope that they'll post it in the permaculture forum at Permies, you know, which is the one that's the international everybody forum kind of a thing. Hopefully, you know, as opposed to the more regional stuff, because like a lot of times, oh, we're having a cob workshop, and they post it in the permaculture forum, and I end up moving it to the Midwest forum because it's in the Midwest, you know.
Right.
And it's kind of like, yeah, please don't do that. Please don't make work for me. So, but green woodworking, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff. Like those guys, you know, and they do the green woodworking, and they like make a chair, and they make their own lathe that's operated by their foot,
right?
You know, out of green wood, stuff like
that. It's awesome. Yeah. I love that. I love anything that's basically made out of the materials that are on your own property. That just blows my mind.
So, all right. We finished reviewing the book.
Right. Oh, what book?
Wait, we finished reviewing. We finished the review of the book that we're going to do for this podcast.
Right.
And we're going to. I think we have one more podcast left.
Right.
For the book, for Sepp Holzer's book.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, anything else? We good?
I think so.
All right. Well, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about hopefully someday doing green woodworking, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.